Working through grief can be difficult for anyone, but for some people, grief combined with trauma can be overwhelming and debilitating. Mental health experts can help someone through traumatic grief, but asking for help can be hard to do, especially if cultural or other barriers stand in the way of getting treatment. We'll talk about traumatic grief and its impact in the first part of today's show. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Gabriel Kramer. We'll focus especially on Black communities in Akron, which have dealt with so much trauma and grief over the last few years, including the police shooting death of Jaylen Walker last summer. Later, we bring you the new episode of our Living for We podcast. It explores why Cleveland ranked last for livability in a 2020 Bloomberg City Lab study. This week, we focus on barrier-breaking women and the added scrutiny and expectation that come with those achievements. But first, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Gabriel Kramer. Thank you all for joining us. Losing a loved one and navigating grief is difficult for anyone. When death unexpectedly takes someone from us, a child before a parent, for instance, or a loss due to violence, the trauma combined with grief can be overwhelming. The stress from a traumatic event can impact a person's entire life, emotionally, physically, and socially. Akron's Black communities have been navigating enormous grief and tragedy over the last 3 years, from higher pandemic deaths to a spike in gun violence to the police shooting death of Jaylen Walker last summer. Getting help to deal with traumatic grief can be more difficult where cultural and societal barriers exist. We're going to talk about traumatic grief and mental health help in this first part of the hour. Joining me in studio for the conversation, we have IdeaStream Public Media reporters Abigail Botar and Taylor Wisner. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hey.
By phone, we have Eric King. He's a counselor with the Mental and Emotional Wellness Centers of Ohio. Eric, good morning. All right, we'll see what we can get with Eric. But if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can send us an email, soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, @soundofideas. A text message will work as well, 216-916-6478. A quick note before we begin, the conversation will touch on traumatic topics such as overdose and suicide, which some listeners may find distressing. Taylor, let's start with you. Let's talk more in depth about what traumatic grief is and how it distinguishes itself from just grief.
Yeah, so basically traumatic grief is recognized as where there's a trauma as well as grief that someone's dealing with. So mental health therapists will look at someone, basically anyone who's alive today has experienced grief, I'm sure, at some point. It's just part of living. And it's difficult for everyone. But, there's a difference between, losing a beloved pet or a grandparent and losing someone, like when you're losing a parent as a small child or, losing someone to cancer that happens over an extended period of time and is very difficult to watch. These things kind of fall into that category of traumatic grief. And basically what therapists believe is that people need to be treated for the trauma before they can go through the stages of grieving. And so that trauma needs to be treated like PTSD, like any trauma. And so you have to go through a process like that. And when people don't get that kind of help, it can affect them in a number of ways. It has a huge impact on the body because of the stress that you're dealing with, holding all that in. And I believe we have a quote here from a mental health therapist, Robin Hill. She describes it.
This concept of not only just focusing on young people, how do we focus on their families as well?
Robin Hill, but I'm sure we'll have it just in a moment here.
Well, Taylor, before we get to Robin Hill, let's talk about this. Traumatic grief, it's obviously misunderstood. Uh-huh. Sometimes even by people who are experiencing themselves and don't know how to navigate it.
That's true. Yeah. I don't think it's one of the more well-known forms of grief. Because grief is so widespread, everyone sort of thinks they know what it is. This one, I think, has kind of slipped under the radar for a lot of folks. So even people who've gone through an unexpected death that is very traumatic, you know, someone losing a child to gun violence. Sometimes they don't even realize that is a trauma. And so, you know, that's why there's a ton of resources out there to help folks. You know, there's this great organization I spoke to for the story called Cornerstone of Hope. They have wonderful grief support groups that can that are really helpful for folks. I talked with a guy, Michael Smith, who is an evangelizes how great they are because it completely changed his life. Basically, he lost his daughter to an unexpected drug overdose a couple of years ago and realized pretty soon that he was not able to get over it. I mean, he was just walking through life, kind of numb is how he explained it, and wasn't really able to grieve. So he approached this group and they got him in a small group of parents who had lost their children in similar ways. And he found it was so helpful for him because they were able to understand. And that's the thing with traumatic grief is it can be so hard for someone to get the help because they aren't able to connect with people who understand what they've gone through. If you think about a drug overdose, right, a lot of people, when they come up and console you for someone who's lost a child, they're going to say, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, oh, I didn't realize they had a drug problem or what was going on. Like, we had no idea. And those kinds of things can be, you know, difficult for someone who's lost someone to hear. And it goes on to them and it's like, oh, I failed as a parent or my child is wrong in some way. And what the process of helping people through that kind of grief does is it takes away the guilt from that person and it takes away the seeing your daughter, seeing your child as someone who's wrong because who's bad because that's not who they were, you know, that's a circumstance. So all of these things, there's a lot I could talk about.
Yeah, but, a lot to talk about. We'll get to it all. But before we shift, remind us who Robin Hill is because we'll hear from her.
Yes. Oh, great. Robin Hill is a mental health therapist, and she works with a lot of people who deal with traumatic grief. And I believe we'll hear her explain sort of what the effects of untreated traumatic grief can be on the body.
There's a heightened stress response going on in the body, which affects your immune system as well as affects, you know, cognitive functioning. These are things you just cannot see. These are phantom things that doesn't show up until later in life.
Fairly good summary of what you're talking about there. Mm-hmm. Abigail, we mentioned Akron. And black folks in Akron have had a lot to contend with these last few years. The pandemic, grief over police shootings of Jalen Walker, you know, all kinds of systemic issues. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about what's happening with people in Akron and the reporting that you're into.
Right. I mean, I think we've all experienced some sort of grief the past 3 years with the pandemic and then directly into the spike of gun violence and then a spike in opioid overdoses. But these are things that directly and disproportionately impact the black community specifically. And then when you're talking about Akron, a lot of people are still grieving and mourning and dealing with traumatic grief over the loss of Jalen Walker and discussions about public safety in their city, distrust in police. So there's a lot of grief happening in Akron right now, and it's really impacting the black community specifically, who, you know, disproportionately have stigmas around mental health that can block people from wanting to get help.
Eric, let's bring you in here. As a mental health counselor, how have the events of the last 3 years impacted your practice and the increased need for help from people like you?
Hey, good morning. Let's see. Over the past year, we have seen a pretty good increase in individuals seeking counseling, but we've had that increase for a while. But our practice, we've seen an increase in all people, but especially black men searching for counseling, as well as those in the black community as well.
Thank you, Eric. Taylor, a lot of your reporting is data-driven, and the data is pretty alarming in terms of how Ohio has tracked the rise in deaths by suicide in black communities, which in Summit County, where Akron is located, is even worse. Can you talk about those numbers a little bit?
Yes. So the Ohio Department of Health has tracked suicide rates, and especially among Black men, that's climbed significantly. It was at 10% in 2014, and it's jumped to nearly 18% in 2021. And if we zoom in on the local level, last year, Summit County reached the highest rate of Black male suicide at 32%, and that's tracked by the Summit County Suicide Prevention Coalition. And like we mentioned earlier, opioid deaths in the Black community in Summit County is also spiking right now. So it's really harrowing statistics that we're seeing, especially in this community.
Eric, in Abigail's story, which you can all find at ideastream.org, you summed up the challenge for mental health professionals helping young people of color, particularly Black men. It's one regarding repairing dignity. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. A lot of times when we talk about suicide, especially with Black males, we look at it from the body. So go work out, strengthen your body, even figure out what you're putting inside of your body. And then the next thing we believe is that Black men have some type of weakness of their mind. And so we're constantly telling Black men or telling them to buck up, to, you know, get your life right. So we're only tackling two spots, the mind and the body. But what really happens is where a Black male is really struggling is that dignity, that spirit. When our spirit is broken, when we feel as though our personhood does not have a voice, that's really where we begin to see the issue. And so when I'm working with Black men or when I'm working with anyone, I approach it from the self-esteem, the self-knowledge, the self-concept of that individual to help strengthen that individual's dignity, to help strengthen that person's personhood, to where even they can take their personhood into account, to where they're working on internalizing their strength as well as asking others to help them strengthen in ways that they need to be strengthened.
A reminder to our listeners and our viewers, you can join the conversation by calling 866-578-0903. Email us, soy@ideastream.org. Also find us on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. Before we get to some calls, I want to ask you one more question. Eric, we talk about these barriers to mental health. You just brought up dignity being one of them. What may prevent those in Black or BIPOC communities, Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, from seeking help?
Stigma. That's, you know, number one. And within this last 10 years, we've been seeing an increase in the amount of awareness of mental health. And so a lot of that stigma is beginning to go down with, you know, throughout the United States and all, as well as the world. But in the Black community, that stigma is still there. We are a triune people. We are mind, body, and spirit. And sometimes the spirit aspect or the church aspects, which our Black communities are connected to, you know, so highly, you know, at one point was looking at it as a prayer way. But, you know, I'm seeing an influx of churches that are partnering, you know, with mental health organizations that are talking about mental health organizations. I want to give a shout out to my brother-in-law, David Washington. He's a minister, and we're all, you know, we're talking about mental health. So I really appreciate what the, you know, church community is doing in bringing in, you know, mental health, you know, representatives in providing that connection of spirituality and mental health within the church.
All right, everybody, 866-578-0903 to join the conversation. We have Elizabeth calling from Cleveland on the line. Elizabeth, good morning. What do you have to say for us?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for this important conversation. I just wanted to bring in the point that people who are not native English speakers or who are not from a culture generally like our westernized American culture have a particularly difficult time accessing counseling and grief support for the trauma they have experienced in their language in a way that is culturally appropriate also, especially in terms of providers who accept Medicaid and who know how to work with interpreters. This is a huge need in the immigrant community, especially, you know, not just for people in refugee camps who have come here from refugee camps, but also for people who, you know, have actively come from war zones over the last, you know, 25 years here in Cleveland. And I haven't really seen the provider, you know, the number of providers or appropriate providers increase. And this is something that I would love to see addressed at a, you know, more comprehensive level in Northeast Ohio generally, because we continue to see more and more people move here. And this is something that, you know, despite the stigma to accessing care, right, to believing that trauma is a thing, we all know that the signs exhibit in the body, and we can address it, you know, at least that way. If we don't exactly, if we're not able to exactly use the words, you know, trauma, for example, or grief, in the way that our Western parlance does. So thanks so much for this conversation. Super important and a longtime fan. Thanks.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We really appreciate it. Eric, that's a really good point, because not only are there people who are lacking access because of cultural barriers or language barriers, there's also, and we report this on health topics outside of mental health, but there's a tendency for people to want to rely on or feel more comfortable with people who are similar to them, particularly in minority communities, easy to relate with. They have life, shared life experiences. And this is something that you're working on in the health profession and the organization you work with. Is that correct?
Yeah, so representation matters. Identity medicine is still something that we connect with. We want to go to an individual that looks like us that can possibly understand. So the more that we're having more representation in the mental health field, the better, you know, the better it is. At our practice, we have primarily, you know, Black and Brown individuals that, you know, practice at our practice. I'm sorry for the redundancy, but also we have four Black, in addition to myself, we have three other Black males that practice, which is really rare for a mental health organization to have so many Black males, as well as so much diversity within their organization. And a part of that, you know, from that, we've decided to create an organization that is, you know, specifically directed towards increasing the amount of Black males in mental health, at which we know will directly decrease and make a positive impact in families, as well as decrease suicide rate with Black males, as well as make a positive impact in families, in Black families, as well as the Black community.
We're going to take one more caller. Eric, I think you might like this one. Claire from Cleveland. Claire, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. This is Claire Campbell. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Claire. How you doing?
I'm well. So I just wanted to call in. I've been hearing you on the airwaves, Eric. I'm so proud. I'm a professor at Cleveland State University in the graduate clinical mental health counseling education program. Eric is a stellar alum of our program, and just, you know, really the importance of the work that Eric is doing in the community and really speaking to continuing to really recruit and encourage those in perhaps marginalized communities, Black and Brown communities, to do this important work. Because again, as Eric has stated so well, you know, people really love to see someone that looks like them when they walk in that first time to do counseling, which is, you know, a big step and usually is a pretty anxiety-provoking experience for a first-time client. And so I'll just say, being in the field for 25 plus years, the good news is that We do see more students coming into the program who are from Black and Brown communities, who speak other languages, international students who are coming to get a really great education, and it just ripples out in the work. So I'm just super excited that Eric is doing what he's doing and spreading such good work.
Claire, we thank you so much for the call. Abigail, you know, while mental health help has gained wider acceptance in Black communities, stigma remains, as we talked about. But there's groups like Love Akron. Mm-hmm. Tell me what Love Akron is.
Yeah. So like Eric said, Love Akron is a Christian-based community organization. And Eric touched on how more churches in the region are talking about mental health. And this is one Christian organization. And there's lots of other non-religious organizations that are taking it upon themselves in Akron to start having these conversations about mental health. For the first caller, I would just want to shout out ASIA, which stands for Asian Services in Action in Akron. They work with community immigrant communities in the city, and they talk a lot about mental health, although, you know, we still need more representation there. So these organizations, Love Akron, Asia, they're really talking about mental health in the city and really starting with kids to kind of destigmatize that. The kids maybe will talk to their parents, will talk to their friends, and kind of seep into the community that way to have these really raw conversations about mental health and addiction and grief.
And we have Boyd Kemp with some voice.
Yeah, so Boyd Kemp is the executive director of Love Akron, and he explained to me how his work with Akron Public Schools allows that broader discussion about mental health in the community.
This concept of not only just focusing on young people, how do we focus on their families as well, who are struggling and who also have some of these mental health concerns or needs?
So he works closely with Akron Public Schools. He also runs within Love Akron a grief recovery method for adults to talk about grief in a non-therapy setting, which he's seen great response from to kind of open the door to professional mental health.
Well, we'll have to end the conversation there, unfortunately. My many thanks to Taylor Wisner, Abigail Botar, my colleagues here at Eastern Public Media, Eric King from the Mental and Emotional Wellness Centers of Ohio. A reminder, if you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 988. Coming up after the break, we bring you the latest episode of our Living for We podcast. It's The Sound of Ideas. I'm Gabriel Kramer. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Gabriel Kramer. Our new podcast, Living for We, explores the livability issues raised by a 2020 Bloomberg CityLab article on a study that found Cleveland ranked dead last for Black women. This week, we hear from two women who have broken barriers in their lives and careers. Those achievements, although separated by decades, came with the added expectations and scrutiny of being the first to hold a pivotal role. Their achievements also raise the question why, in 2023, there are still so many barriers yet to be broken for Black women. Here now is the newest episode of Living for We.
When you see old movies or documentaries, it seems like Black people living in the South picking cotton all day in the hot sun for white landowners was a long, long time ago. But for our first guest, 94-year-old Miss Arnell Hendricks, it's like it was yesterday.
I picked 400 pounds of cotton a day.
Wow. I've heard stories about picking cotton. Was it as awful as I've heard?
Yes, it's just as bad as you heard. It was on your back, your fingers. You get those nails on your fingers and from picking in the bowl of cotton. And the hot sun, it was like 110 degrees sun. And at the end of the row, there was the trees, and we go under the tree for a little while to cool off.
Get some shade.
Mm-hmm, for shade. Mm-hmm.
Miss Arnell is a former nurse. She's lived her entire adult life in the Cleveland area. She moved from a small southern town in 1948 during the Great Migration of Black people from the South to northern cities. I was introduced to this wonderful woman by my mother. They both grew up in Eudora, Arkansas. Current population 1,600 people, if I'm being generous. My mother and Miss Arnell went to school together.
I just wanted to leave Eudora, you know, because there was nothing there. We had one grocery store, two drug stores, and that was the size of it. So it was no job for you to do anything. So, and I wanted to go to school, and I got they call it like a scholarship, like $250 scholarship.
To assess the current state of livability for Black women in Cleveland, we thought it would be interesting to hear the perspective of someone who's seen a lot of changes. She came here at a time when opportunities were very limited for Black women. So we packed up our equipment and went to visit Miss Arnell at her home on a rainy afternoon. And I'm going to call you Miss Arnell because that's what I call you all
the time. That's okay. Yeah, I know you do.
You know, that's how we are. With our elders, we say Miss Arnell, right?
Right, right.
Her mind is still very sharp, but a recent fall has created challenges, including learning to interact with her Alexa smart speaker.
It's
time for brunch. You need to stop and eat.
Say what?
That's your reminder that it's time for brunch. You need to stop and take a snack or anything.
What did she say?
The machine was saying it's time for you to have brunch.
Are you hungry?
No, I just ate.
Okay, you're good.
Yeah, she reminds you, she really. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Shut up, shut up.
Just an average day at Miss Arnell's house. After moving to Cleveland with that $250 scholarship, she enrolled in nursing school and lived in the historic Phyllis Wheatley home in Cleveland.
Phyllis Wheatley was supposed to be a home away from home for Black girls. It was kind of like home where you had your bedroom was upstairs, and they had a nice living room downstairs for you to receive your company. And after 11 o'clock, you're supposed to be in it before 11 o'clock at night. So my mother kind of enjoyed that I'd be having some kind of strict recitation, you know, like she'd be in 11 o'clock.
She felt comfortable knowing you were staying there where they had some restrictions.
Right.
Now, how did things go at nursing school?
Oh, at nursing school, I went to Metro.
To Metro Health?
Mm-hmm.
Here in Cleveland?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was called City Hospital at that time. I was the only Black person in the class.
You were? What was that like?
Oh, it was terrible. Yeah, always she. They called me, you know, like, she did this. You know, some of those girls was prejudiced. I guess that's all they knew. But they always called me she, you know.
They wouldn't call you by your name.
Mm-mm. But so happened, I did real well in school. I mean, I did real well. I made A's and B's in class, and I worked real hard to get what I had, what I got, you know. But they wanted to, it was two of us, they put the other girl out. I don't know why they put her out.
There was another young lady who was Black?
Black, uh-huh, but they put her out.
Well, that must have been disappointing, because if I would have been in your shoes, I would have been, like, happy to see
one other Black person.
Right,
yeah.
Were you disappointed when you heard they put her out?
Uh-huh, I really was. I was hurt. You know, and we always sit together.
That must have been like a real, what's the word I'm looking for? Culture shock? Because here you're coming from Eudora, and I'm assuming you went to high school with mostly Black kids, right?
All Black.
All Black. And then you come to Cleveland, and then you go to nursing school, and now you're the only Black
only
person.
Only Black person in the room.
That must have been.
It's frightening. It is, in a way.
It was frightening?
In a way. They look at you like they wonder what you're made out of, you know. During that time, kids was really, I guess they didn't know anything else but to be prejudiced from their parents. They were prejudiced or something.
Did you befriend anybody? Did you make any friends with anybody?
I tried, but it seemed like they were scared of me, you know.
What was it like as a Black woman working? Like, what hospital? Well, I should ask first,
University Hospital or Metro. But what we had to do, if there was a white woman in the room, we had wards, they call them wards, four beds in the room. And this white lady doesn't want to be in the room with the Black woman. So we had to move the Black woman out of that room to satisfy her.
So if there were two patients in a room and one was Black and one was white, if the white person didn't want the Black person in there.
We moved the Black woman. Even with the patients, they would turn their light on. You know, they want to use the bathroom. And they would call, they want you to use, let them put them on a bedpan or a urine or whatever they needed. But they didn't think the white nurse should be doing it. So, you know, they would ask you for it. Can I have a bedpan? Can I have a urine? You know, why the white woman just passed you and you didn't ask her, why didn't you ask her for one? But they thought this is your job, you know.
So you had to deal with some patients who were not exactly open-minded.
Most of them was not open-minded.
So, Miss Arnell, some people would look at you, you know, look at your life. Mm-hmm. You came here from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
You became a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, would you say your life has been pretty good here in Cleveland?
I would say not really.
You know, because a lot of people talk about, like, the discrimination that was going on in the South back then.
Mm-hmm.
But they talk as though, like, the northern cities, that wasn't going on.
It was. Living condition, living area, you know, it has always been that way. It really has. What do I want? I want justice and be treated just like you are being treated. Why should we have separate schools, separate area where we live? You can tell that white folk living with some areas, black folk living in the other area. And it's not that some of us wouldn't take care of our property. It's just that they got us that way.
Cleveland is notorious for being racially segregated. Even today, most black families are clustered on the east side. So imagine how bad it was back in Miss Arnell's day. Some suburban neighborhoods like Shaker Heights are proud about being diverse now, but black middle-class families suffered explicit discrimination while trying to move from the city to the suburbs for a better life, like so many other racial groups had done when they gained upward mobility. Did you ever have any trouble when you were buying your houses, you and your husband?
Mm-hmm. We had problems.
What kind of problems?
Of getting a loan and the percentage that they want us to have. At that time, loan was like 4%, and they want us to pay 6%.
Which house was that for? The first house?
No,
or the house in Shaker?
The one in Shaker.
So they wanted you to pay above the interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to end up having to do that in the end?
Mm-mm.
What did you do?
One of my husband's friends was white. And he got the house in his name.
So your husband's white friend had to get the house
in his name.
In his name for you guys.
Mm-hmm. Then we had to transfer back in our name after he got the house.
And that was in order so you didn't get stuck paying extra interest.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, that's true.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think when you hear that study named Cleveland the worst city for black women?
I think Cleveland is a bad place for black women. And it shouldn't be that the first black woman did so and so and so. The first black woman, it should be the first. It should have been happening all the time.
We should be past that.
Yeah.
First.
That's what I'm saying. It should have been like that all the time. It shouldn't have to be said and done that we are the first so and so and so. No. Mm-mm.
It would be nice if we were beyond black women still having to be the first. Miss Arnell was likely one of a few black nurses in Cleveland in the 50s. Now, in 2023, another nurse has broken a glass ceiling. Our next guest, Erica Steed, is the new CEO of Metro Health, and unsurprisingly, the first ever woman, and not just black woman, but any kind of woman, to lead a hospital system in Cleveland. While she's only been on the job a few months, she says her number one goal is to eliminate health inequities, inequities that she's experienced firsthand. And as we've explored on this podcast, that's a huge undertaking.
We've been chasing this for centuries, right? We have yet to even scratch the surface on really what we can say we've eradicated healthcare disparities. That's something I'm hungry for. I've always been a fan of the work of Metro Health, mm-hmm. but the Pittsburgh study for me came as just as part of my overall area of interest and focal point well before. So now it's come full circle
That,
especially being a black woman and landing up dead last on that list. It inflamed me. It really did. My life story is all about pain, and I've always been fueled by that. I was very young when I lost my mother to a very rare form of leukemia. First, she was misdiagnosed. She was late caught in terms of misinformation, delays, missteps and ball drops. And just long story short, my mother didn't end up passing away from the leukemia in and of itself. She ended up passing away from an experiment. And that experiment touched me so deeply because my mother nor her family were engaged in this process that she was being experimented on. And, you know, at the end of the day, the side effect of that experiment is what took my mother's life.
Oh, my God.
Had she recognized the fact that she was being experimented on, and a huge side effect is death, 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 death.
And she didn't know.
I think that she would have made a much more informed decision. Her family would have wrapped around her and enjoyed the final moments of her precious life as opposed to going through that pain and torment during the last several months of her life. This is what truly rocked me to my core. My baby sister, my younger sister, she passed away from breast cancer also. This is where it becomes a statistic, such a significant aspect of what we need to disrupt in this broken system. It wasn't until I actually went through these personal experiences that it resonated with me that this is an absolute calling, and I was in this place for a reason, to disrupt the brokenness, to reverse the centuries of inequity, to actually achieve the fundamental goal of health equity. And we also need to do a better job of representing those that we serve and start to break down that those walls of distrust that has been built up because of, you know, all of these various negative experiences. So I can honestly tell you from my own personal purview and my own personal experiences, I'm extremely guarded. It takes a lot for me to even share and open up to the various providers that I may seek out just because I've had so many bad experiences. We need to do something about that too, because that's part of the problem.
One of the things that we're exploring with this podcast is, you know, that when that study first came out, it was a couple years ago now, you know, some people say we went through a racial reckoning in this country. Has there been some movement? It's kind of what we're exploring, right? And some people will look at you and say, there's an example. Some movement is actually happening. We have the first African-American woman who is running a major healthcare system in this city. So that's progress.
It absolutely is progress. And I'm proud to say that I'm the first Black, first female, first nurse in 185 years to run this storied institution. There are only 16% of healthcare systems across the country are ran by women. And if you peel it back even further, less than 6% are minorities, and that encompasses both men and women. We still have some work to do. So where I'm absolutely proud is I represent a signal of hope, momentum, the motivation to continue to break down those chains and break down the barriers and fight through the adversity and most certainly get comfortable being uncomfortable navigating ourselves through this very windy road. But it's still hard. But I can honestly tell you that I'm encouraged and very optimistic about the future, given the fact that we've made this groundbreaking, historic, courageous decision to say, I want to influence what that narrative actually looks like.
Often when Black women are invited to have a seat at the table, it's because they're needed to come in and clean up a mess.
Uh-oh. Now I'm afraid where are you going to go with this question?
If you haven't heard, there's been drama at MetroHealth over the past few months. Drama that has nothing to do with Ms. Steen.
Breaking news, the president and CEO of MetroHealth, Akram Boutros, has been terminated.
Akram Boutros, MetroHealth's former president and CEO, with nearly a decade of experience at the organization, was abruptly fired in the lead up to his scheduled retirement last December. It was alleged that he paid himself over $2 million in bonuses without the knowing consent or approval of MetroHealth's board.
Suing for wrongful termination, defamation, and damages.
I have never in any way acted on an unethical matter. That is why I went to the High Ethics Commission, and I was eager to go to them so that they can clear my name.
It's been messy, to say the least. This case will likely be litigated in the courts for a while, but it was unfortunate that it blew up in the public eye just as Ms. Steed was about to take over.
Well, just put it like this, okay? I've never been one to run away from a burning building. I wasn't even 3 feet tall. I already knew that I was going to be a firefighter. I was going to be a trailblazer. I was going to be a difference maker. As a nurse, I chose to get into the emergency room and critical care because you're troubleshooting, you're solving for problems, you're dealing with crises. I chose to go become a Big Four consultant where I've traveled the world solving problems. For more than half of my leadership experience, I've been a transformational expert. Crisis is innate, is natural to me. quite frankly, I'm good at it. If not me to help navigate through, then who? Being a Black woman, being a Black professional, being someone who has definitely worked her way up, I don't think that I've seen the last of that adversity. In all of my experiences, and I've had some great ones, I'm born and raised in Chicago, but I feel right at home here, and I feel like I'm not in this alone. Just because of the legacy that is being built. This is not just for me. I don't just represent Dr. Erica Steed. I represent all of the voices that are around, and I represent what the next generation is going to actually look like. We all have to make this count, and we all have to make this work.
It's time to step back into Dr. Angela Neal Barnett's office. I know you've missed her, and there's a lot to unpack from these past three episodes on healthcare. Dr. Angela says that the stories shared on the podcast have been harrowing, but not just in their disturbing details.
There was another woman having major migraines, another woman of color, screaming at the top of her lungs, and I'm bleeding out, and neither one of us are being attended to.
That honestly was the scariest point of my life. Like, this little baby just came in my life.
My mother then went to a nurse in charge and said, I need to talk to you because they're gonna kill my daughter.
The fact was that these are not outlier stories. All of us know Black women who tell similar stories.
I'm glad you said that, because I think it's very difficult to have data to really share with the audience and say, these are not the outliers. This is the lived experience of many, many Black women in the healthcare system in Cleveland and elsewhere, because many people who listen to those stories may think in their mind, oh, well, those are just the extremes. Those are the outliers.
As someone who listens to Black women who have gone through the healthcare system, these are our stories. In fact, sometimes I'm listening and I have to pause and think to myself, didn't I just hear this? Is she telling me the story again? And I realize, no, this is her story, but you heard it last week, and you heard it the week before, and the week before that. And if we went back decades and decades and decades, those women would probably tell us the same stories.
It's interesting to me, though, that when we were talking about Miss Arnell Hendricks, that when you said when you heard her story, it made you think about how much things had not changed. And when I initially listened to her story, and then I think about now we have Dr. Erica Steed, who's now running MetroHealth, the hospital where Miss Arnell trained to be a nurse all those years ago, that shows how much has changed.
The fact that we are still first and onlys. I mean, she was a first and only. You talk to these doctors who are first and onlys.
And now Dr. Erica Steed.
It's the first.
And only in Cleveland. Yeah.
So I think that there has been some progress. But what I take away from the stories is I know what you are going through. And I know that it is easy to get weary, but know that there are those who came before you and those who have come after you, and that change will come and is coming. You know, one of the things about Jasmine and birthing Beautiful is that what they provide those women with is the fact that when they are giving birth, they are not alone. And many of them would be, except for the work that those doulas do.
Racism is what is causing Black babies to die, and that racial bias in healthcare systems are what is causing moms to die. What I have determined in myself is that we can't change hearts and minds, and that's how we're going to be there to hold our clients' hands all the steps of the way?
I was recently interviewed by a major media outlet, and they were talking about the use of doulas. And they said, well, doulas are for rich white women. And do you think that this, you know, could really work for Black women?
Really?
And I said,
That's interesting.
That's not been my experience, having worked with Birthing Beautiful. So that has not been my experience, that doulas are inherent and natural in the Black community, and we are simply coming back to what has been our heritage. There's no need for us to sacrifice ourselves, to sacrifice our babies. As Black mothers, we want better for our children than we have for ourselves. And if we think about it in that way, starting out with our children coming into the world with whoever you have in the birthing room and a doula, what better way to welcome them to the world?
Well, Dr. Bradley talked about a lot about the social determinants of health.
Yes.
The stressors and the strife that people have outside of the healthcare system. When you're, you know, when maybe you don't have a car to get to the doctor, or maybe there's lead pipes in your house, or maybe the air is bad in your neighborhood. Those are all social determinants of health. And she kept pointing to those as some of the reasons.
Yeah, social determinants of health are I ain't got none. I ain't got no food. I ain't got no car. I ain't got no house. And I ain't got nobody who looks at me and respects me for who I am as a Black woman. These things have their roots in racism.
So to the Black women listening to this podcast, would you say to them, make sure you get a Black health professional, a Black doctor if you can?
And if you can't, make sure you take along an advocate. And if that's not possible, then I think one of the things that we have to start doing is training Black women how to be advocates for themselves. We can also train how to advocate in medical situations when you believe racism is at play.
Is there like a little bit you could share about that right now?
Sure. Sure. One of the things that we always teach people is action planning. What is the problem? What do you want to happen? Here's the problem. Here's what I want to happen. How do you make that happen? And, you know, you're in a group, so you're thinking about, okay, how do I make this happen? What happens if you get stuck? If it doesn't go the way that it goes, and the planning around that, and then practice that. And we know from the literature that this is helpful. We know in terms of racism, it's very helpful. One of the things that adolescents are trained in are, what are you going to do when someone calls you the N-word? And many of us think, oh, it's not going to happen. And then it happens. And so—
And then you're flabbergasted.
Yeah,
when
and then
happens.
You're caught flabbergasted. Yeah. And so we can do the same thing in terms of our health care. We can practice. And in our own work, we find that, yes, when they practice, when they action plan, and they're doing it with other women, it makes a difference. I went in there and, you know, what, just like we practice, this is what I did.
So write it down. So have that plan down when you go in the doctor's office.
Right. I mean, and you practice. And you practice with a positive outcome. If it's not a positive outcome, you come back. What went wrong? Okay, so what do I need to do to achieve the outcome that I want? And the outcome is very simple for most Black women. I want someone to listen to me, and I want to be heard.
So do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with the audience, with the Black women in the audience, around navigating this healthcare system, whether it's here in Cleveland or wherever, the biases and things that we have to navigate?
trust your gut. If it sounds wrong, it probably is wrong. And so ask the questions. Trust your gut. Advocate. Bring an advocate with you. And if you're not able to do that, practice. Practice what you want to say, what you want to know. And every Black woman who's listening to the sound of my voice deserves to be heard.
Next time on Living for We.
I was gifted and talented. I graduated the top tier of my class, but I was told that I had to take remedial courses at Howard.
At Cleveland Heights, a lot of people place more value on the white students' education.
To come into this space that was not built for me, that was intentionally designed to keep us where we are on the bottom of everything. But here we are, killing it in these spaces designed to kill us.
We're hitting the books and diving into the world of education and school for Black girls and women in Cleveland.
That's our Living for We podcast, hosted by our Director of Engaged Journalism, Marlene Harris-Taylor. We'll give you more Living for We Wednesday on The Sound of Ideas. You can catch up on previous episodes on your podcaster provider or by visiting our website, ideastream.org. Just click on the logo for Living for We in the right tail, and it'll take you to the show page for the podcast and all of its episodes. To get the last word on today's topics, you can send us an email, soi@ideastream.org. We are on Twitter, @SoundOfIdeas. I'm on Twitter, @GabrielKKramer. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we'll discuss a new effort to help Clevelanders get the legal help they need, even when they can't always afford to pay an attorney's fees. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. You can hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Gabriel Kramer. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Goodbye.